Welcome to Intercultural Yoga. My name is Raymond Reyes, and I'm the Associate Provost and Chief Diversity Officer at Gonzaga University. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the relationship of the earth and its ancestral memories in the mountains, in the water, in the sky, and all around us, that this is the homelands of the Spokane tribes of Indians in Wahpeton, Washington. This is their land. Gonzaga University is a settler organization on occupied lands, and we're grateful to be here and able to do this program today. Why intercultural yoga? Intercultural yoga is an opportunity to stretch ourselves in areas of our life, both physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, that we've never ventured before. It's a working from the inside out, but also I like to think of it as learning begins where our comfort zone ends. And so hopefully we can have robust conversations about topics and issues of the day that make us feel uncomfortable. I think that I know that listening and suspending certainty and having curiosity does develop our intercultural fluency. And have we got a treat for you today? We have somebody who is par excellence when it comes to challenging assumptions. Our guest today is Charlita Shelton, Dr. Charlita Shelton. She is somebody that I have known only for eight months, I think it is. And if there's anybody that's a Renaissance person, is anybody who is a utility player in higher education, it is Dr. Shelton. Let me explain. You, like in baseball, you have utility players that can play several positions and do them quite masterfully. She has been a college president at least twice. She has been a provost. She has been a chief diversity officer. She has occupied many positions in higher education at the highest level of leadership. And she does it well. But check this out. She's also a former Marine. And you mix that up with her father was a farmer. So she knows about farming. She knows about the Marines. And she knows about higher education. She knows how to get stuff done. She's got a strong work ethic. In fact, she introduced me to a new word that was somewhat foreign to me. But this is her mantra in life, particularly when she's working with you on a project. Key performance indicators. She's in key performance indicators. So, Dr. Shelton, welcome to this conversation.
Well, thank you, Raymond. It's a pleasure to be here today.
What I want to talk about is a continuation of what we've been putting our attention on, the aftermath of George Floyd's murder and the sustained outrage that we're hearing from our white brothers and sisters. But also something that you and I have touched upon in the past, and it has to do with, you said something to me recently. You mentioned this idea that history informs the future within the earlier work of diversity in higher education. So I'm interested in talking, and particularly because you and I were fortunate to see Patrice Cullors here. In fact, was probably one of the last major gatherings on our campus before the pandemic hit. And that was February the 12th, 2020. And she filled the house. It must have been 600-700 people in that place. One of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. But in the conversation that we had about how history informs the future, you mentioned something about historically black college universities and the role that they played in being able to define diversity in higher education. Could you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Well, certainly. Well, first, before I do, so Raymond tells the story of the two of us working together, and actually next month it will be a year that I have been here at Gonzaga. And I'd like the audience to know that there no meetings are accidental, ever accidental. So actually I would have met, I did meet Raymond in 2002 when I served as the Chief Diversity Officer for the University of Phoenix and Apollo Group. We happened to be at a conference in New York City, and it was a conference that was held by the Society of Human Resource Management. And Raymond there, who has now been Gonzaga for 32 years, Raymond actually introduced the keynote speaker. He spoke himself. The keynote speaker was Coretta Scott King. And so fast forward from 2002 to 2019, and we meet again. So I always tell that story because it has, it's significant. But yeah, so when you look at, in particular, HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, they were created, actually there was an HBCU that was created prior to slavery, ending the slavery, 1864, 65. But this HBCU was created for free slaves. And then it was the idea thereafter of this notion that would be considered segregation later on, separate but equal, Plessy versus Ferguson. So the idea is that blacks wanted to be educated. Educated meaning from a, you know, from a college and university standpoint, a degree standpoint. And there was no means for them to attend white institutions. So thus the creation of the HBCUs dating back, my goodness, you know, to the late 1800s. You look at Wilberforce, you look at Howard University, certainly Morehouse and a number of others that, by the way, still exist today. And then it continued on, because then you had, after Plessy versus Ferguson, or during that time, this notion of separate but equal, but it was never equal. There was nothing equal about being separate and how blacks were separated even in a higher education, from a higher education realm.
Yeah. You know, excuse me, what's interesting, you mentioned the word freedom in passing. John Lewis just passed away, yes. And they had his funeral last week. And I have a quote that I want to read to you, because I think it relates to African Americans, Black America, as well as Native American and Indigenous people, probably communities of color when I think about it. And the relationship of these communities to education is a great equalizer. That education is an implement of self-determination and freedom. But then the irony, and I want to get into this later in this conversation, the irony and contradictions around that, because then some people say that education, K-12 and higher ed in white America is a socialization factory to make people white. And so it's an interesting tension around purpose of education, but it all traces back to freedom. The idea that the more education you have, the more opportunity you potentially have. You have greater levels of freedom. But listen to what John Lewis, and this comes from a piece that Tony Stewart wrote in the Coeur d'Alene Press last week. Mm-hmm. He wrote an editorial, and he, as you know, he's the founder of the Kootenai County Task Force on Human Relations, and took on Richard Butler back in the 70s. And they've been around for about 40 years fighting for civil and human rights. But in his piece, he quotes John Lewis, and I think it's related to the conversation we're having right now. He says, "Freedom is not a state, it is an act. It is not some enchanted garden perched on high, a distant plateau where we finally sit down and rest. Freedom is the continuous action we must all take, and each generation must do its part to create even more fair, just society." So he saw freedom as not a destination or a point that you arrive at, but yet a constant process. And it seems to me that there's an intimacy around education and freedom. How do you think? And then the other piece I want to overlay in all this is, I'm thinking about people like Martin Luther King and even Malcolm X and Maya Angelou and James Baldwin, and I mean the list goes on, Langston Hughes. There always has been this alignment of African American religious thought. So almost the religious, spiritual, and the political activism associated with freedom is about. Can you talk a little bit more about historically Black college and universities in that context?
Well, in that context, really you're looking at the freedom for Black individuals or African American individuals to go to college in the first place. There would have been a minute number of them that would have been able to even afford to go to college. So the freedom of being able to, because we needed the education being the great equalizer, as you just mentioned, to be able to do strategic planning about what was created or what has been created with structural inequality. Yeah. So you have to be educated to understand the system, to have knowledge of how the system works, to make changes, and even then, very small changes, but here we are in 2020 having the same conversation.
Well, and as you know, in your latest position at Gonzaga University, is you've been the czar, the guru of the pandemic preparations that this institution has been about for the last, month and a half, 2 months. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know that the pandemic has amplified the economic disparities among communities of color versus the white majority, or technological gaps in K-12, where not all households with students at home have equal access to technology, or even a laptop. Health is another one. So yes. all the economic disparity, technology gap, health, education, housing, I mean, everything. I mean, a lot of, I don't know if it's true or not, but 40 million people losing their jobs in the last 5 months or so. And many of them are people that you and I know in these communities where they're on the edge with no margin. They lose a job, they're 1 month away from being on the street and not being able to make their rent payment or their car payment. So this idea of the great equalizer is more than just education, though, because, and maybe you and I have talked about this before, is that when Martin Luther King was talking about human and civil rights, he was an advocate for education big time, because he understood the intimate relationship between education and economics. And it went like this. It was a cafeteria counter story that I always remember, and maybe I've mentioned this to you before, is that the civil and human rights effort gives you the right to sit at the kitchen, at the cafeteria counter. You have the right to sit there. The important issue, though, is if you don't know how to read, you can't read the menu. And if you don't have money, you can't pay for the meal that you're going to order. So there's this kind of interdependent relationship between human rights, civil rights, education, economic, job, and ability to pay as part of this freedom that we're talking about right now. And I think that communities of color are uniquely positioned to deepen and expand the notion of freedom than ever before in this country. I think in the history of this country right now.
Well, that's true, but if you look at, even during that time of the 60s, if you look at the entertainers like Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, and I can go on and on and on, where they were very rich relative to wealth because they were top black performers, asked to perform before white audiences, but had to go down the street to get a meal. That was no freedom. Where's the freedom there? So economically, they were flourishing, but still they weren't equal, and there was less freedom, you know, where they had to sleep. If there were places, there were no black hotels for them to sleep. They'd sleep on the bus. So that's interesting, isn't it? But back to just, you know, the pandemic, and the differences is it's like you know, kick them when they're down. So it's the notion of, we know that there's a propensity of individuals of color, and especially black individuals, who are affected because of health conditions. So whether it's diabetes, or whether they are in renal failure, or whether it is high blood pressure, they're victims to the virus, to COVID-19. And then you look at the number of individuals of color, BIPOC, you know, and that, of course, black, indigenous, people of color, the industries in which they work, and the bus drivers and those who got affected by COVID-19, or whether or not they were the individuals who were doing for custodial work, everything that is service oriented. Okay, number two, so that's a strike against them in terms of the virus. Number three, economically in this country, the careers in which they, you know, which they held, a number of them lost. And so now, you know, without any type of additional stimulus, these individuals will lose their homes. They're even a month away from, listen, they're trying to negotiate right now for these individuals to stay in their apartments to pay their rent, where their rent is supplemented. So it's insult to injury. So everything is mixed up now. And, you know, we talked about the pandemic is just not the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, if the pandemic goes on with racial injustices, especially with the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, we can go on and on and on.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that this moment in history is different? When we talk about history, can inform the future. Do you think that this moment that we're experiencing is different than the 1960s or any other time when people have resisted the status quo and petitioned and advocated for human rights? Is this different than right now what we're seeing in America?
I don't believe we'll go back to sleep. This here is the primary differences that I'm seeing, is that this has been not only the awakening of America, it has been the awakening internationally. And it's been the awakening by our white allies. The protests, most that you were seeing across this country, and what was occurring internationally, have been a bunch of white folks. Yes, there were people of color with them. So that makes a difference relative to now white allies and seeing the sins of the past manifested to the sins of current day and what could be the sins of the future to stand up for equal rights.
It is interesting now because I think there's a state of readiness with our white brothers and sisters to directly confront white privilege, white supremacy, and white fragility. Those were topics that were made people very, very uncomfortable. And so that the whole premise of safe space. But now I think what we're graduating towards is brave space, where I see a significant number of white allies willing to step up, take responsibility for their own narratives, and be able to talk about white supremacy that informs white privilege. And then go into the dark night of soul as it pertains to white fragility, the denial, avoidance, and minimization of what pain has been caused for all people, not just for communities of color, for all people, though.
Yes.
But you're right, because I think what happened shortly after in early June was people coming to me, and probably to you as well, saying, we're tired of talking about it. What can we do? But what people don't want to hear is immediately putting the mirror back on them, reflecting back the answer to the question, work on yourself first, because we see things how we are, not how it is. So, you know, it doesn't seem like you're doing anything about the other, because I think part of white privilege is to other people to an extent where you sanitize any semblance of connection with the issue at a personal level. So I think right now the moment is different than I've ever experienced in my life. And I'm a product of the 60s and went up through all the period of our shared experience in this country. But you're right, global as well as United States. When Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech in the Grand Mall, there were 250,000 people there. And when I reviewed the tape about 3 weeks ago, I was interested in seeing that again, and I did. There were a sea of white faces. He even knew strategically you needed to leverage, and particularly at a predominantly white institution like Gonzaga. It's one thing, and I want to trace back to the historically black college universities, tribal colleges, or Hispanic serving institutions. And what do they do different than white majority institutions in higher ed do? And what can we learn from them? But more importantly, during this moment, during this historical moment about the racist pandemic, what can we learn from them in terms of conveying to our white brothers and sisters what they need to be doing, what they are invited to do?
Well, yes, I mean, so, but back a little bit. If you think about the freeing of slaves, whose hand was incredibly powerful in it occurring? That was white abolitionists.
That's true, yeah.
It was the white abolitionists that helped in many stories, but in particular, if you think about Harriet Tubman, to get black mm-hmm. folks, meaning those slaves in the Underground Railroad, all up to Canada. By the way, before the existence of the HBCUs, there was an institution, I can't think of the name of it, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it was Quakers or not, that received free blacks into the institutions, integrated with whites. And this was like in the 1855.
That's progressive.
So that just speaks to these allies and the allies that we need and what can be learned. I think with historically black, institutions are ever changing, and they're not all black anymore, by the way.
Right,
there's all
right,
kind of
right.
folks that attend, but obviously from a curriculum standpoint, you know you're gonna go into HBCU and you know that you're gonna have an understanding of intercultural differences because of the courses that are, so mm-hmm. you know, you're gonna see, you know, whether it's in your history courses or your sociology courses, we can go on and on, there's gonna be remnants of complete diversity. That's the major difference in their learning. So they're rooted in that, and there are some, and so in a predominantly white institution, unfortunately what's occurred is it's said, and you know, I've been told many times of this of individuals who are professionals in DEI work, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, is that predominantly white institutions were not designed for people like us.
Right.
They were designed for white folks, not for us and our culture.
Right.
I didn't learn anything about, aside from watching television, you know, because I'm a product more of the 70s, I didn't learn anything in high school about African-American history at all. I didn't learn about African-American history or people of color history until I was in college. And I'm not that old.
No, you're not.
I'm not that old. And I didn't learn about it until I was in college because I was taking what? African-Americana studies courses at Western Michigan University.
So do you think that given the content difference curriculum at the historically black college university versus a PWI, does it just stop there, or is it also process content, or may boldly ask, is the purpose of education different in these communities of color that have higher ed institutions like tribes, Hispanic America or black America? Or do you think there's a interest convergence, there's a similarity, a purpose of education?
Well, I think it'd be a similarity. I did not attend an HBCU myself, so I won't pretend to be an expert relative to the level of education or curriculum. Of course, nieces that have attended HBCUs and have done incredible, Howard University, matter of fact. My other niece attended, now I'm trying to remember, out of Ohio, come to me in a minute. Kentucky, she attended Kentucky State University. I think they are just more so well-rounded in their education, because their education was really designed for them. They happen to be people of color, so it was designed for them. And so they relate well. There are criticisms with HBCUs in the sense, this type of criticism that, especially when they were primarily just black, so different now that, well, will that student really understand, a person of color, that BIPOC person, will they really understand what the true world is about? Because their world there is primarily black. And even with the number of faculty, you know, who's teaching, the administrators to their staff. But once they leave an HBCU, gain their undergraduate degree, whatever have you, how will they relate to the outside world and the reality of the outside world?
If you've been at Gonzaga almost a year, you've served as a African-American woman, as president a few times, what would you say to a white student at Gonzaga? What do you want them to know that you know, to interrupt the negative historical pattern of history repeating itself when it comes to race relations?
Well, I would want them first to be educated about just that, to be educated about the past and what has happened in this country from both a systemic racism perspective, which also really relates to this structural inequality. I'd want them to understand their very privilege and not to be defensive by their privilege. I don't need the fragility piece coming out. Understand where you are because you happen to be a white individual attending Gonzaga University, which is a predominantly white institution, but an excellent, outstanding liberal arts Catholic Jesuit institution. So understand that the world is beyond what you're experiencing now, and you have to take a real concerted effort to research that on your own if it's not going to come about. Now, of course, Gonzaga's done a fabulous job in terms of this fine chief diversity officer that they decided to hire 12, 13 years ago, and what has happened, now an office of diversity, equity, inclusion. And so we now have a new program here at Gonzaga with critical race and ethnic studies, and we can go on and on. And so now there's opportunities for students, white students, to learn a little bit more about more than what they have grown up with or their surroundings as they know it. It's the differences, the other people's differences, and to recognize it and not make a comment like, you know, they see someone of color, you know, and I don't see color. It's almost insulting. Yeah. You should see color. That's important. Our differences are important, but our differences bring us together as well, but we learn from that.
Yeah. That's a good way to put a period at the end of the sentence in terms of, what was his name? He wrote Ecology and Gregory Bateson. He said that, it sounds like psychobabble, but it eloquently hits what you just said. Differences make the difference through which learning can thrive. that homogeneity, you don't have the creative tension that exists in heterogeneity. You have hope?
Well, we have to have hope.
For a future conversation, I want to talk about hope.
Hope.
We need hope right now.
We need a lot of hope right now.
Yes.
Because everyone's getting a bit stir crazy with this pandemic and, again, race relations and everything that's going on. I'm concerned about the mental health of this nation, and it's going to manifest itself once this pandemic dies down. It will manifest itself in terrible ways, and we have to be ready for that.
Yeah.
We need hope.
An opportunity to grow and learn.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today. Really appreciate the conversation.